And I remember in the 1950s wondering, do you suppose there's any chance that he's still alive? Somebody said, oh no, that's 30 years ago. It was my brother Mike who said, Pete, did you hear? They've rediscovered Mississippi John Hurt. I said, really? How'd they do it? He told me the story. Well, they listened to one of his records, says, I was born in Avalon. And they looked up in the atlas, and sure enough, there was a town in Mississippi, Avalon, Mississippi. And they got in the car and went down there.
Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. Pretty mornings in Avalon, warm me there all the time.
In March of 1963, a young blues enthusiast from Washington, D.C. traveled to Mississippi searching for a musician assumed to be dead by many. His last recordings were over 30 years old, and no knowledge of his whereabouts, either dead or alive, was to be found anywhere. The only clue to follow was a line from a 1928 recording suggesting this musician lived in a place called Avalon. The resulting trip, which began on a whim, led to a second career for an authentic musical legend and a lasting influence on thousands of listeners and musicians. The legacy that remains to this day reflects the quiet power and dignity of a remarkable musician, still beloved by all who had the pleasure of hearing Mississippi John Hurt.
Always on my mind. Pretty mamas and Allen want me there all the time.
John Hurt was born in Teoc, a small town in Carroll County, Mississippi, on March 8, 1892. His family was large, 8 brothers and 2 sisters, and music was a casual part of their lives. John, however, showed a serious interest in the guitar, even from an early age. Hurt's mother purchased his first instrument when he was 9 years old. It cost $1.50. From the beginning, Hurt was a unique musician. Despite his roots in the Mississippi Delta, he developed a lighter, smoother style, nearly devoid of the choked strings and bottleneck slides so common with bluesmen of his generation. Compare Hurt's guitar style to Charlie Patton's, which follows. Both were from the Delta region and both were of the same generation. Hurt's recording is from 1928, Patton's from 1929.
Raise a baby, get your big leg off of mine. Raise a baby, get your big leg off of mine. It's so heavy, make a good man change his mind.
The rhythmic syncopation in Hurt's style featured an alternating bass pattern played with his thumb. His guitar playing thus reflected more piano-derived influences, specifically the ragtime and marches so popular at the turn of the century.
The Delta is a real specific region that's in northern Mississippi, and it was really isolated from the mainstream.
North Carolina musician Scott Ainslie is widely known for his musicianship and scholarship. He's just published an exhaustive study of the legendary Delta blues man, Robert Johnson.
And so in that sense, Hurt may not be that much of a Delta musician, because I don't think that he developed his style in isolation at all. I think he probably had more exposure to the music of the time than Skip James or Son House or Charlie Patton. With Joplin's music and the advent of John Philip Sousa's marches, those rhythms and chord changes infected the popular music that black guitarists were making near urban centers where that music could be heard. They might get into town and hear it at the drugstore. They could hear it, you know, somebody might have a record player. I mean, there were black businessmen, there were actually people in the trades, not agricultural workers necessarily, who might have the wherewithal to get a phonograph together or to have a radio and hear some of that music on the radio when that technology was first available. And so they could get in, be exposed to it, and incorporate that music in their popular music. Johnson, I mean, in later years, there was a style developed that we identify with Delta Blues. It's been widely documented because it's the roots of rock and roll. And the other music, piano-oriented guitar playing, has been relegated sort of the dust heap of history because it's not, it didn't turn into rock and roll. It seems to have sort of eddied off into itself and sort of stopped as a popular music form. In addition, the structure of the music in the Delta Blues is the we can differentiate between John Hurt's music and the Delta Blues. If we can do that, then the Delta Blues have the call and response structure built in that is endemic in African music, and it's it's just always there. There's always a space left, even when it's just guitar and voice and nobody answers back. The guitar has a space to talk back. It's very rare you find a tune that goes straight through. And Hurt's music, while he repeats lines, and there is room for that call and response structure, it's in a context of this sort of pianoistic style. The thumb worked the low strings, like the left hand of the piano, and very much to the point to say that. And the two, your index finger and your middle finger play the high strings and do all the little syncopations, so you get a very quick... Although Hurt didn't play much bottleneck-style guitar, he added his own touch when he performed a song like Talking Casey. It's wonderful what he does with it, and he uses it, you hear that call and response, the answer and the talk back, and it's all happening. It's a wonderful tour de force, it really is.
He couldn't stand that, he told his father, he said, get the bell, let's go. I heard the bell, something like this.
What made Hurt truly unique was his ability to draw on influences from both black and white musical traditions.
John played a lot of country dance tunes, white country dance tunes.
Tom Hoskins is a blues scholar and musician from Annapolis, Maryland.
He played with several other people around there, especially this white group. It wasn't a group, it was a fiddler, Willie Narmore. And he had a guitar player named Shell Smith, but Shell wasn't real good. Shell was real kind of boom chang, and Willie much preferred to have John play with him. You know, they played for church dances and square dances and picnics.
Hurt's association with Willie Narmore helped broaden his repertoire to include early white country music as well as the various blues, ragtime, and sacred music influences from within the black community. In addition, it was Narmore who suggested that OK recording producer Tommy Rockwell give Hurt a listen. Always on the lookout for authentic talent, Rockwell traveled to Avalon, where Hurt was living in 1928. After being awakened at 3 in the morning, Hurt was asked to do an audition. It took only 2.5 songs to convince Rockwell to set up a recording session for Hurt. In February of 1928, Hurt traveled to Memphis and recorded Frankie and Albert and Nobody's Business for OK.
Frankie went down to the corner saloon, didn't go to be gone long. She peeped through the keyhole of the door, spied Albert and Alice's arm. He's my man, and he done me wrong.
The record sold well enough to warrant a second session, this one recorded in New York City in December of that year. That session yielded 12 sides, 10 of which were released.
And I'm gone. I'm sure he's gone. This is the hammer that killed Johnny, but it won't kill me. But it won't kill me.
Hurt was planning another recording session when the Depression intervened. The music industry, like the rest of the economy, was in a slump, so the third session never happened. Hurt returned to Avalon and took a job as a farmhand. He played occasional parties and church suppers, but never took his guitar outside of Carroll County. Undoubtedly, he never would have had it not been for Tom Hoskins' arrival over 30 years later.
He couldn't have lived more than a quarter mile from the Delta. But just that quarter mile was the difference in his style of music from the Delta-type blues. I mean, just symbolic that he lived there.
Hoskins, like many other musicians of his generation, had grown tired of the slick, showy styles of folk music so popular in the late 50s and early 60s. He began collecting original recordings, as well as information about the musicians. Hoskins was particularly fascinated with Hurt's 1928 sessions, but he could find no further information about this musician. Taking the refrain from Avalon Blues as a clue, Hoskins traveled to Mississippi in March of 1963. The first three people he met when he arrived directed him to Hurt's three-room shack.
So I drove up there and stopped the car, and I saw a little house, a little shack house, and could see lights coming through the windows. And so I went up on the porch and knocked on the door, flap, flap, flap. And here's John saying, "Yeah, who that? Who that?" And I said, is this where Mississippi John Hurt lives? And you hear all this laughing, because they thought it was, you know, one of their friends or buddies or something, you know, come down there just pulling his leg a little bit. And John, I'm standing there at the door, John comes to the door like this, and he's still laughing, he's opening the door, oh my goodness, strange white man is standing in my door, I'm in deep trouble now, what is this? And I, you know, I was so excited, I just stuck my hand out and I said, "Hi, John, my name's Tom, I'm from Washington, I've been looking for you for a long time."
One of Hoskins' first tasks was to convince Hurt that he wasn't in trouble. A young white stranger from Washington, D.C. wasn't the kind of company Hurt was accustomed to.
"I've heard this man's old records and, you know, and I want to talk with him, I want to hear him play, and, you know, no, there's no, you know." Assured him that there was no trouble and no, we weren't down there civil rights scene or, you know, registering voters or anything like that.
In addition, Hoskins wanted to find out if Hurt could still play, so he left a guitar. It was a Friday night when Hoskins made his first call. He returned on Sunday, March 3rd, 1963, and recorded Hurt playing, singing, and talking. One of the first things Hoskins asked was how and when Hurt learned to play the guitar.
"Don, what's the name of that?"
"John gets those things when he wants to ask you."
"Yeah,
it's the little
hammer." "I remember since, what you call it, a cabin."
"Yeah, that's what it was, yeah."
"Now I'm looking for the cabin.
When did you start to play the guitar, John?"
"I started to play the guitar when I was about 9 years old. Yes, sir.
Did anyone teach you how to play, or did you just...
No, sir. No, sir.
You just started picking it up?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Was there anybody that you listened to who you tried to play like?
Yes, sir.
Who was that?
William Henry Carson.
William Henry Carson.
Yes, sir.
The man that he did learn something from was a fellow named William Henry Carson. And he used to come and court John's mother, because John's father was dead. And he would come and he'd bring his guitar, and he'd oftentimes stay all night. And he'd put his guitar away in the corner or something. And, you know, little John get up and sneak in there and, you know, get it, take it back to his room or outside someplace, you know, and just play real quiet and just try to learn and imitate what he'd seen.
The trip to Avalon produced more than a simple rediscovery. Now that it was clear Hurt could still perform, Hoskins suggested another attempt at playing music professionally would be more lucrative than a $28 a month job as a farmhand.
You know, I talked to him about when I was there the first time. I said, you know, there are a lot of people that would like to hear you play and hear your music, and I think you can make some pretty good money if you're willing to come up and perform and make records. And he thought that'd be a good idea, and we recorded during that time, and then he went back to Mississippi, and we brought him back up again for the Philly Festival. And it was obvious. I mean, just the response that he was getting, that you know, this thing was just going to snowball. And so we moved him up here to Washington.
It was in Washington that Hurt began his second musical career. With the help of Hoskins and Dick Spotswood, a well-known record collector, Hurt became the house musician at the Ontario Place, a local coffee house. Several of his performances there were recorded. The 1928 sessions, while demonstrating Hurt's unique musicianship, couldn't begin to hint at his natural rapport with an audience, as these 1963 recordings so clearly show.
Made him sort of mad because he had to stop his train to come his cousin. Here's what he said. I hope y'all know what he's saying.
A great deal of publicity ensued for Mississippi John Hurt's appearances at the Ontario Place. Among those who read about the rediscovery of Hurt was Washington blues musician Archie Edwards, who quickly became one of Hurt's best friends.
On a Thursday, I read the damn newspaper. Lo and behold, there sits a man playing the guitar. Mississippi John Hurt is now appearing nightly at the Ontario Place here in Washington, Northwest Washington. I jump up, run to the telephone, call down there. I said, is it true that Mississippi John Hurt is playing here? Yes, he's playing here every night. Do you know John Hurt? I said, yeah, I know John Hurt. Are you from Mississippi? I said, no, I'm not from Mississippi. How do you know John Hurt? I said, well, it's gonna sound funny. I said, back in the early 30s, I heard one of his recordings. Stagger Lee and Candyman, and I said, I play the guitar, and I learned it, hoping that I would carry his tradition on down the road. He said, well, come down here and meet John Hurt and tell him about it. So I went down to the club that night, met John Hurt, told him that I played the guitar, played his music and all, and buddy, we became the best friends.
Many of the young musicians seeking out original artists such as Hurt were white. Edwards sees this as a reflection of a new era.
The blues are a whole new horizon for the white people. You know why? Because back in the old days, it was a disgrace The parents wouldn't allow them to listen to it. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, when they broke down the damn racial barriers, the young white kid grabbed the damn guitars and stampeded us. And buddy, they went crazy and still going crazy over it. What they wasn't allowed to listen to one time, is the sweetest thing that ever happened to them.
Despite the adulation of a new, largely white audience, the old fears still remained. Edwards remembers that.
His outlook on the world and the public was very limited. Now, at his age, he was very fearful of white folks, very fearful, very skeptical of them. So one day he came, I brought him here. He told me, said, Brother Arch, I played at a place the other night. And he said, they're taking pictures of me. And said, a white woman kissed me. He said, do you think that they will put that in the newspaper and let the people back in Mississippi see it? I said, no, John. He said, well, I'll tell you one thing. If they do, I can't go back home.
It was Hurt's appeal to the white, urban, college-educated listener that gave him the marketability so attractive to the folk music record companies. Hoskins recalls that.
He would get up there and play You Are My Sunshine, for instance. And it was more readily familiar to the ear than, say, House or Patton if he'd been alive. You know, you pretty much have to be into the blues to appreciate, you know, those kinds of people. But, you know, somebody just who got into it, say, from Peter, Paul and Mary, kind of, or Chad Mitchell Trio, you know, could hear this and go, wow, you know, that's really beautiful.
My only sunshine, you make me
John was what I would describe as light blues country music, and his music was mostly uplifting, where the other guys are much deeper, more somber players.
Patrick Skye was one of the younger musicians befriended by Hurt in the early 60s.
He tried to relate to the audience, and he'd talk to them, and they'd laugh, and he would laugh. And a lot of these players, they'd get on stage, and they were deadly. I don't want to call any names, but they just didn't have any kind of rapport with the audience at all. They just expected the audience to just listen to their music. And, of course, there's a blues audience that will do that, but that audience is much smaller than the audience at large. I think John garnered people who normally wouldn't listen to blues at all, and probably haven't since they heard John Hurt. John and I kind of related to each other because we were both from the South. And in that sense, we had culturally a lot in common. And I think that, you know, we kind of instantly, it drew us together. And because we used to sit around, and John used to talk about Mississippi, and I'd talk about Georgia, and we talk about fishing and hunting and all the things that we did, you know, that we had in common.
Skye's friendship with Hurt led to a fruitful recording career for the Vanguard label. In addition to playing second guitar on some numbers, Skye produced several of these recordings.
None of the records were theme records. We didn't go in and say we're going to record 12 songs for this record and 12 for that one. John and I went in there for about a week, and we'd record every day, and then they would take the things and put them together and make records.
Beside a busy studio schedule, Hurt kept up with regular appearances at many coffee houses and festivals. Perhaps his most talked about performances were at Newport, beginning in 1963.
He had such taste, you know. Taste in a musician is often in what you don't play, not what you do play. I mean, he played just the right notes and no more.
Pete Seeger remembers.
It's a wonderful thing how a good musician can cut through all sorts of barriers, and people who didn't normally listen to blues wouldn't have listened to some old man from a small town in Mississippi. They were just on their feet cheering. And John came back year after year to Newport. I once had the unenviable job of having to tell him there's no time for an encore. They were backstage, said, "Pete, we're running late. We've got to speed up. You've got to tell everybody there's no encores." And I said, "Well, how about John? He's only on for 10 minutes. You mean he can't take one encore?" "No, there's no time." I like a damn fool, I went along with it. I should have just walked off and said, "Just say you tell him." But I was a well-disciplined organization man. And I went out and I said, "I'm sorry, John, they've told me backstage there's just no time for an encore." He smiled, says, "That's all right." And he just waved to the crowd and walked off. He loved to make music, and sure, it was nice to have thousands of people applaud him. And he met some interesting people traveling, and he sure he went back home and told his wife, says, "Yeah, met a fellow up there in Newport who said he'd listened to my records 30 years earlier and thought I was dead. Can you beat that? He thought I was dead."
In the 2 years following his rediscovery, Hurt's performance schedule became very busy. And for the first time in his life, he was making a respectable income from music. But he always missed Mississippi, so in 1965, he returned to Carroll County with his wife Jessie and their two grandchildren and purchased a house in Granada.
After a while, he'd made enough money that he didn't, you know, really have to be worried very much about it. And you know, he was a country man. He didn't really enjoy living in the city because, you know, you can't go out and go squirrel hunting or, you know, you're living in the city and he couldn't go out by himself. He just couldn't, you know, walk down the street and feel very comfortable about it. So he wanted to move back, you know, where he could be comfortable and enjoy what he'd made. So that's what he did.
By this time, Mississippi John Hurt had become a firm fixture on the folk music scene. He was making a comfortable living, but he was not a young man. Jesse Hurt remarked that, by rights, John went into this when he should have been coming out.
It may be that he overextended himself, you know. It often happens. Young people will stay up all night and forget that an older person cannot stay up all night. They might have put some concerts too close to each other, and they had to go without sleep two or three nights in a row. Didn't realize that a man in his 70s needs to get his sleep.
And I called John, and he said, "Well, Tommy," says, "you know," he says, "I don't really need to go." He says, I don't feel all that well." I said, "Well, you know, are you sick?" And he says, "No." He says, "It just, you know, I just don't feel quite right. And you know, I'd do better if I just sat here and just kind of rested up."
"Yeah, you just well get ready. You got to die. Oh, you just well get ready. Yes, and me. You don't know the minute of the hour. Just well get ready. You got to die."
Mississippi John Hurt died on November 2nd, 1966, at the age of 74. He was survived by his wife, his son, 17 grandchildren, and several thousand musical children, who carry on his legacy to a new generation of listeners. His rediscovery is thus perpetual, as younger performers find a musical master who transcends the notion of fashion and teaches them through his recordings, or through his many musical offspring, the values of simplicity, elegance, taste, and beauty.
If I could, I surely would, stand on the rock where Moses stood, Pharaoh's
whose army got drowned. Oh, baby, don't you weep. Oh, baby, don't you weep, don't you moan.
Avalon Blues, Mississippi John Hurt Remembered, was produced at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Production and narration by Danny Gotham. Special thanks to Tom Hoskins.